James Montgomery Boyce tells a story about Benjamin Franklin. Benjamin Franklin was the United States plenipotentiary to Paris. And when he was there, he encountered a great deal of mockery and hostility to his, Benjamin Franklin's, appreciation of the Bible. So in other words, James Montgomery Boyce calls them the cultured despisers, and that's the term. They thought the Bible was just a joke, and the fact that Benjamin Franklin would occasionally quote the Bible was an occasion for taunting and mocking. So one day, Benjamin Franklin wanted to prove, or rather test and see, how well the people who were laughing at his love for the Bible knew the Bible. So he came into one of the many gatherings of high society there in Paris, and he said that he had come across a manuscript of an ancient poem that he wanted to read to the Parisians. So they gathered around respectfully, and unbeknownst to them, he read Habakkuk chapter 3. Which ends with our words tonight. I hear, and my body trembles. My lips quiver at the sound. Rottenness enters into my bones. My legs tremble beneath me. Yet I will quietly wait for the day of trouble to come upon people who invade us. Though the fig tree should not blossom, nor fruit be on the vines, the produce of the olive fail, and the fields yield no food, the flock be cut off from the fold, and there be no herd in the stalls, yet I will rejoice in the Lord. I will take joy in the God of my salvation. God, the Lord, is my strength. He makes my feet like the deer's. He makes me tread on high places. And when he finished, his audience of cultured sophisticants erupted into applause and said, "That is one of the most beautiful poems. Where did it come from?" And he said, "That is from the prophet Habakkuk, his closing prayer in the third chapter of the book." And it is indeed a beautiful, beautiful passage. Remember the unfolding of this book. It begins with a complaint, right? Habakkuk complains that God appears to be silent or uninterested in the degeneracy and injustice among his own people. God responds and says, "I have not been silent and I have not been blind. I see what has happened, and I am raising up a people, the Chaldeans," which are basically synonymous in many usages with the Babylonians. And that's how we've used it in our handling of Habakkuk. "I am raising up the Babylonians to send them to discipline my people," which elicits an even more intense objection from Habakkuk, who says, "The Babylonians, they're worse than us." And Habakkuk complains again. "How could you send the wicked, militaristic, bloodthirsty Babylonians? Aren't they in need of your judgment?" To which God says, and I'm summarizing here, "Yes, and they will receive my judgment. I will use them to discipline you, but then I will discipline them." And God describes the Babylonians as a, and you might remember that we talked about how this was a surprising development, because at the time when Habakkuk gave his prophecy, Babylon was not the major military power on the scene. It was still Assyria. So there's a prophetic element here that Babylon will become great and they will spread throughout the earth, and then they will come and subdue you. But God goes on to say, "But I will not abandon my people. I will discipline and I will overcome the Babylonians." And in fact, the peoples who have been oppressed by the Babylonians will themselves rise up and respond, and Babylon's violence will come upon their heads. So what we have in the end of Habakkuk 3 is the complaining prophet's prayer of resignation to God's perfect providential plan. Do not ask me to repeat that. We have Habakkuk saying, okay, so things are bad and they're about to get worse, but I will dare to trust that you know what you're doing. And I just want to offer this to you tonight as a model. Will you dare to trust that God knows what He's doing in the worst of times when you're tempted to doubt? So, 3 points. Number one, it is possible to trust God, to trust in God when you are scared. It's possible to trust in God when you are scared. 3 points and 4 verses. Verse 16. Watch what the prophet says. I hear and my body trembles. What's happening here? Well, you might remember last Wednesday that the bulk of Habakkuk 3 leading up to Habakkuk 3:15, the verse that immediately precedes this, is Habakkuk's prayer and song of acceptance, but also amazement at the strength and might and power of Almighty God. He gives a kind of lost in his thoughts, stream of consciousness recital of the mighty deeds of God. Do you remember last week? He alludes to the Exodus. Remember, he talks about God's chariots riding on the sea. He talks about God's subjugation of the waters. Do you remember we talked about how in Scripture, whenever God is depicted as having power over the waters, it's a powerful sign of His deity. And it's also, if you recall this big word, it's also an eschatological image. It's an image of the final consummation of all things at the end of time. You might recall that in Revelation 21, John says there was no more sea. The waters have finally been conquered. You might recall that one of the clearest expressions of the deity of Christ comes from His disciples when they see Him walking on the water and calming the storm. Who is like this? Who can do this but God alone? So Habakkuk has praised the might and power of God, and now he says, I hear, meaning two things. I hear now, I remember, I see that you are mighty and powerful throughout history, and I also see now what you're saying. How many of you in here have to hear God speak a number of times before you're able to say, okay, I finally get it? How many of you in raising your children have said things a dozen times and realized that the first 11 times it just did not get through? As part of parenting, as part of life, it's fascinating that Habakkuk here at the end of the book says, okay, I hear. I hear. John Steinbeck said of Liza Hamilton in East of Eden that her only intellectual pursuit was reading the Bible, and that she kept on reading it long after she had stopped listening to it. And we're like that. Lots of people read the Bible and never listen to a word of it. But Habakkuk says, I hear, and here is the, you might call it the psychosomatic effects of the sovereignty of God on Habakkuk's body. I hear, I now see who you are, and my body trembles. My lips quiver at the sound. Have you ever been so overwhelmed by something that your lips quivered? I mean, that's unbelievable. Rottenness enters into my bones. That sounds disgusting, but it's actually a colloquial way of saying that he has lost all strength. And it goes hand in hand with the next phrase, my legs tremble beneath me. It's a picture of complete physical collapse before an overwhelming truth that he is not able to take in all at once. And let me just say to you that if somehow, for a fraction of a second, we could see a little more of God than we're able to see. If you could see all of God for a second, I think we would be instantaneously incinerated into ash. I think the glory of God is hotter than 10,000 suns. I read an article a few years ago, some Spanish scientist, kind of in a tongue-in-cheek way, but they published an article arguing that heaven was actually hotter than hell. I don't mean that in a profane way. It's hotter than the place hell. Why? Because they said that there's no need of the sun, because in Revelation it says the glory of God provides the light. So it was kind of an interesting statement. They said, based on that, heaven would be the hottest place on earth. If you could see, which is just kind of a provocative nonsense thought, but if you could see the glory of God, it would incinerate you and me. But what if we could see a little more of God to where it did not destroy us? I think that would happen. Complete physical collapse. Your legs would give out from it. How many times in Scripture, when an angel of the Lord appears, do people just fall on their faces? Every knee will bow does not necessarily mean that there will be a conscious decision on the parts of those bowing to do so, right? It's more of an involuntary reflex before the awesome grandeur of God. We will all fall on our knees or our faces. It's an awesome thing to think about. Kurt Vonnegut, the great writer, once said that how human beings perceive reality. I think this was in Slaughterhouse-Five, which really is an amazing novel. How many of you have read Kurt Vonnegut's Slaughterhouse-Five? Yeah, a few of you? Yeah. Kurt Vonnegut survived the firebombing of Dresden by him and some other soldiers holding up in the slaughterhouse number 5. That's where he got the title for that. It's an unbelievable novel, but very weird too. I think it was in Slaughterhouse 5 where he said that human perception of reality is like a man lying on his side in a crate, and in the crate there is a small hole drilled, and you're just able to squint and look out the hole, and you are inside of a boxcar on a train moving at high speed. And on the other end of the boxcar is the door that is cracked that much, and the trees are whipping by you. What you could perceive there is about how much of reality human beings actually see. And that's probably true, and that's also biblical, because Paul says in 1 Corinthians 13, now we see through a glass dimly. Paul, and saying of the church, even as Christians, we only see in part, but the day will come when we see it all. Which is amazing. So, if you get a glimpse of it, it lays you low. Yet, I will quietly... What's interesting about that? Has Habakkuk been quiet up to this point? No. Habakkuk and Peter probably are friends in heaven because they both talked when they didn't know what to do. So do I, according to Ronnie. Yet I will quietly wait for the day of trouble to come upon people who invade us. That verse is heavily disputed in terms of exactly how to translate it. Some of your versions may put it separately. The question is whether or not he's saying, I will quietly wait for the day of trouble to come upon us from the people who invade us. Or is he saying, as the English Standard Version renders it, I will quietly wait for the day of trouble to come upon people who invade us. In other words, okay, Babylon will invade us, but I will wait in the midst of it, knowing that you will bring trouble upon them. Regardless, he resigns himself to wait. It is possible to trust in God when you're scared. But I just want to tell you that the Lord does not expect an unnatural stoicism, a kind of emotional detachment. Oh, my house is burning down. I guess I should pray and read the book of James. Well, you should probably scream and get out of your house. But you can trust God even while you're screaming and running out of your house, is the point. I mean, Habakkuk's having a complete physical breakdown here, but what he's saying is, I dare to believe that it's going to be okay. And there's comfort in that. It's okay to say, my legs give out from under me, my lips quiver, but I will wait. Even though trouble's coming, I will trust in God. The second thing is this. I love, by the way, that David Garland, the Old Testament scholar, summarizes this as saying Habakkuk, quote, was all shaken up. That's his scholarly opinion. Number two, it is possible to have joy in God when things look hopeless. So it's possible to trust in God when you're scared. It's possible to have joy in God when things look hopeless. Look at verse 17. Though the fig tree should not blossom, nor fruit be on the vine, the produce of the olive fail, and fields yield no food. He's painting a picture of the bleakness of the reality of God's people. Everything's failing. So listen to this. Though the fig tree should not blossom, nor fruit be on the vines, the produce of the olive fail, and the fields yield no food, the flock be cut off from the fold, and there be no herd in the stalls. Stop right there. In an agrarian society, verse 17 of Habakkuk 3 is as exhaustive and a statement that you can make of societal collapse. You have there the removal of everything necessary for life. The fig tree doesn't blossom. There's no fruit on the vines. The produce of the olive fails. The fields give no food. And then the flocks are cut off from the fold and there's no herd in the stalls. Meaning, if you take everything from us or allow this to happen, yet, verse 18, watch this, yet I will rejoice in the Lord. I will take joy. It says there's a repetition of the note of joy. I will take joy in the God of my salvation. Can I ask a question? Are you where or am I where I could say that? What an unbelievable statement. If you take every single thing I have, I'll still believe in you. But not just that. What did he say he would do? He'd have joy. Ralph Smith, Old Testament scholar, notes that the word rejoice has in Hebrew the cohortative sense, which, quote, is the strongest possible way to say that one is determined to rejoice in the Lord regardless of what does or does not happen. In other words, that's a superlative. I will have the most joy. I will rejoice. Joy is something you fight for in the midst of pain. You don't give up. Who was it, C.S. Lewis, who said, I believe, that God whispers to us in our pleasure, but he shouts at us in our pain. That pain is God's megaphone to get our attention. Those things that make us wonder if he's there may be signs of his presence like nothing else. So, to have joy. Now, again, I want to draw a distinction between joy and happiness. I think you need to make that distinction. Joy is a deep-seated state of mind that refuses to yield to despair. Happiness is the emotional dressing that oftentimes comes with joy. But my opinion here is that you can have joy even in moments when you don't have happiness. I think joy is a foundational virtue. It's something deep under the soil. Happiness are the exciting moments when joy bears the fruit of laughter and smiling and excitement and happiness. So you can have joy, which is simply a deep contentment and trust in God, even when you are not happy. That's my opinion. Because the options are not either you're giggling or you've become an atheist. Right? You get my point? It's not either I'm giggling because I'm so happy, or I'm an atheist. No, it's possible to believe deeply and have joy in the midst of tears. You say, what would that look like? It would look like pretty much any Christian funeral I've ever attended or done. Christians grieve with a mixture of joy in the promises of God, but sorrow in the midst of grief. Grief is not the absence of joy. Despair is. You can have grief and yet trust. Right? You can have grief and yet know deep down and have a peace and a joy that God is still God. My third point is this. It is possible to live out God's ultimate victory in the midst of what appears to be defeat. It is possible to live out God's ultimate victory in the midst of what appears to be defeat. Final verse. God, the Lord, is my strength. Watch this. He makes my feet like the deer's. He makes me tread on my high places. And then I love the ending. To the choir master with string instruments. I love it. Habakkuk ends by saying, break out the guitars. Which is really fun when you encounter people who just hate stringed instruments. Church is the organ. Well, not according to Habakkuk. Yeah, I mean, it's fine as a matter of preference. Some people don't like guitars. That's fine. But my point is, if you just say, well, there shouldn't be guitars in church, the lyre, L-Y-R-E, existed before the organ. Do you realize that you can out-tradition the traditionalists by saying that they were plucking strings well before they were pressing keys in the history of music? I like these moments. It makes me happy because everyone seems uncomfortable. But you get my point? It's great to have a piano. I love the piano. I learned to play the piano. I played Horse Walk in the Park at my fifth grade guild when I was this big. My head was still this size. And I've never forgotten how to play that song. You want to hear it? Yeah, okay. So my point is the piano is a beautiful thing. I mean, especially under the hands of a master, right? But the more important point is this. Do you notice that in verse 17, Habakkuk bemoans the fact that there are no animals? But in verse 19, Habakkuk has become the deer. You notice this? It's a beautifully paradoxical thing that in the same moment when he weeps that the flock is cut off from the fold and there are no herds in the stalls, God the Lord is my strength. He makes my feet like the deer's. He makes me tread on high places. Can I say to you, as your corpulent pastor, don't give up. Don't give up. Don't give in. Dare to fight for joy. Fight for joy when you have no human reason to do so. Fight for joy when, especially when everything's going wrong. Refuse to let go of hope that is grounded in the glory and goodness of God. The message of Habakkuk.